Well, the North Carolina Reading Service brings you the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. I'm John Federson, and as usual, I'll be reading this week's edition of the Independent Indie Week. And before I get into details, we just thank our musicians for today, presenting our delightful chamber ensemble, playing, they're titled Hogs from Hades, and they're bringing us our music for today. Thank you, folks. You just roll on out. There they go. All right, so we are in the edition of Indie Week of April the 27th of 2023, and I'll start reading our articles in just a moment. All right, our issue this week, again, works from both the print and the online edition of Indie Week. And the cover story in the print edition is the 10th anniversary of Moral Mondays. Its co-founder, Reverend William Barber, answers a series of questions. A decade ago, it says, writes Jasmine Gallup, Reverend Barber II led 17 people in a peaceful protest of the Republican-dominated North Carolina legislature, which had begun a campaign of injustice through laws halting Medicaid expansion, cutting unemployment benefits, and restricting voting rights, among other things. In a deliberate act of civil disobedience, the small cohort gathered inside the state legislative building and was later led out in handcuffs. The protest, dubbed Moral Mondays, quickly gained momentum. Within a month, hundreds were gathered in downtown Raleigh to protest the actions of the legislature. Barber, then president of the state's NAACP, had created a movement that energized and empowered people of all races, religions, and political affiliations. Today, the Moral Monday movement has spread nationwide, and Barber is calling for a recommitment to the cause. Protests are still organized through Repairers of the Breach, which trains communities in moral movement building, and the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Recently, Barber was also invited to Yale University to found a new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. This week, on the 10th anniversary of that first Moral Monday protest, we asked Barber about how the movement started, why it should be a part of policy discussions, and what's changed since 2013. What triggered the Moral Monday protests? And Reverend Barber answers, in 2012, Tea Party politicians won a supermajority in North Carolina because the federal government refused to strike down the 2010 gerrymandering plan. A supermajority of extremists got elected not because they got the most votes, but because redistricting stacked, packed, and bleached districts in such a way that it limited the impact of the progressive vote. I remember meeting with then-Governor Pat McCrory and saying it didn't matter if he was a Republican. If he would address the issues that were facing North Carolinians, like health care, if he wouldn't attack immigrant and LGBT communities, if he would work to pass a living wage, we would work with him. He made no promises. In 2013, we had this massive gathering in the street, and we put our agenda out there. The first thing the new General Assembly does in 15 minutes, without any debate, without any allowing any doctors to talk, they denied Medicaid expansion. Then they attacked unemployment. Then they attacked the LGBTQI community. Then same-sex marriage, public education. And after they did all that, they said, we're going to go after voting rights. They put together a voter suppression bill in the North Carolina State Senate. It had about 40 changes, including rolling back same-day registration and early voting. It was at that point we said, wait a minute. Every crucifixion needs a witness who says this is not right. That's when we started Moral Mondays. Moral Mondays spread from North Carolina across the nation. Did you ever think the protests would become so big? When we started, we were planning on just going in for one day. 17 people ended up going in with placards that had quotes from the Constitution, from Scripture, and they arrested us. The first person they arrested was a woman in a wheelchair. She had cerebral palsy. She was there because she said our state blocking Medicaid expansion is immoral. We knew that we had to challenge what was going on because it was wrong. Little did we know, just like Rosa Parks didn't know when she sat down on that school bus, that it would spark the largest sustained effort in the South at a state house. Nor did we realize what we started, that the next week more would come from all over the state. They were black, white, brown, native, Asian. There were Republicans there, Democrats there. We went on for years. We couldn't vote. We knew they would outvote us, but we said every Monday, we're going to make it clear we're not going to let them do it in the dark. What effect did the Moral Monday campaign have? Just after the first 14 weeks, Pat McCrory's approval ratings had dropped from 60% down to about 39%. Public policy polling directly credits the work of Moral Monday with the unseating of Pat McCrory and his extremist ideals. A few weeks ago, the New York Times said that if it had not been for Moral Monday, you might not have a Roy Cooper. And if you didn't have a Roy Cooper, you wouldn't have North Carolina being one of the few southern states where a governor was able to expand Medicaid, which then benefited hundreds of thousands of people. It was the activists that kept the issue alive and would not let it go. The work of the movement protected our voting rights. As a legal strategy, we filed a lawsuit against the massive voter suppression deal. We were able to defeat rollbacks of same-day registration and early voting. We were able to defeat photo ID. We won that case, and we set a precedent for how to win voter suppression cases in the South. Because when we filed our case, the plaintiffs were every race, creed, and color. We had black plaintiffs, white plaintiffs, Jewish people, young folk, and veterans as plaintiffs because we wanted to show that voter suppression hurts us all. What do you think is so powerful about this Moral Monday movement? The movement has shown people that even when you're in the minority in terms of the vote, you don't have to be quiet and sit down. Part of what the movement has done is put legislative records before the people so that candidates are not able to sell what I call a bag of goods. There's a statement that says, telling the truth in a time of lies is revolutionary in and of itself. A moral movement bringing people together around these critical challenges is in itself revolutionary. Even when the extremists led the General Assembly, we proved you don't have to sit, just sit down and take it. You can continue to stand and struggle and cry and fight together. One third of the electorate now is poor and or low wealth. So if you work to mobilize and educate poor and low wealth voters, help them understand what their power is. Many of these states are not red states. They're unorganized states. They're uninspired states. That's why Moral Monday is still needed, because we got to do this hard work. People don't often talk about morality and policy. Why is it important to look at it through this lens? Every step in American history has required at some point a movement that challenges injustices, not on policy, but on moral principles. The civil rights movement was a moral movement, the abolition movement, the labor movement. One of the greatest models of transformational movement is what happened in the first Reconstruction, when former slaves, former free black people, and poor whites came together and formed fusion coalitions to rewrite the constitutions of Southern legislatures. They didn't do it because they were Republican or Democrat. They framed their movement in moral terms. They said, quote, if we say we hold these truths to be self-evident and all men are created equal, then we have to look at every policy and question whether it does that. Looking at policy through the lens of our deepest religious values, of moral values, deepens our ability to address issues. The language of left versus right is too puny, is too small. We have to say some things are just wrong. 140 million people who live in poverty, 87 million people who are underinsured or uninsured, massive attempts to suppress the vote, it's wrong. Fundamental human rights require that we don't let this exist, and we have to challenge these injustices. Oftentimes, there are forces that want to limit the moral discussion to things like abortion and where you stand on gay rights and same-sex marriage. They don't want to deal with the moral issue when it comes to banking and tax breaks and living wages, when in fact, budgets are moral documents. You are now the founding director of Yale University's new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. What is the goal of this center? The main thing is training seminarians and undergraduates on how to do public theology, creating a fellowship think tank, if you will, for looking at and producing policy rooted in our deepest moral, constitutional, and religious values. It's about where, because of our deep faith, we stand on the critical issues of our day. And if you're not a person of faith, but you believe in the moral arc of the universe, or if you believe in the value of the Constitution, then when you look at a piece of public policy, you don't ask, is it right or is it left, Democrat or Republican? You ask, does it establish justice? Does it promote the general welfare? Does it ensure equal protection under the law, regardless of creed, regardless of sexuality? If it doesn't meet those standards, then we challenge those kinds of laws as being immoral. They're far less than what our deepest religious and constitutional values call us to be. What is the state of the Moral Monday movement today? This past June, replies Reverend Barber, over 150,000 people of every race, creed, and color joined in the Mass Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers' Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls. Out of that, we had a massive voter mobilization that touched more than 8 million voters in 15 states. In those states that had success among progressives, the impact of these poor, nowhere voters coming out was major. What we're seeing now is an attempt to roll back again. So that's why, on the 10th anniversary, we are not just having an anniversary, we are having a recommitment. Because even with all that's been done, North Carolina still has over 4 million people who are poor and low wealth. North Carolina still is not paying people a living wage of at least $15 an hour. So we still have work to do. Next, the print edition, Tomasi McDonald writes, A Second Chance. The poet and playwright Keith Antar Mason once said that life may have begun with the creation of atoms, but cultures are built with the telling of our stories. He said, when you're telling your story, you're also telling my own. April is National Second Chance Month, and if nothing else, the Bull City believes in the God of Second Chances. Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry and officials at the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke Law School have partnered with local members of the clergy to present two events this week they hope will highlight the role communities can play in helping formerly incarcerated people lead successful lives. At the heart of the events are stories shared by formerly incarcerated people with the goal of creating a more fair, safe, and just future for all, according to a press release from the Durham County District Attorney's Office. One of the two events is a panel discussion on Wednesday in West Durham that will feature formerly incarcerated people living in the Bull City who have navigated relatively successful lives since their release from prison. One of the panelists, T. Lamont Baker, has quite a story to tell. Baker, now 36, was 19 years old and days from starting his freshman year at UNC Charlotte in 2006 to study mechanical engineering when police charged him with second-degree murder and discharging a firearm into an occupied dwelling. Baker says he was with a friend who got into an argument with an acquaintance. The argument escalated into violence. Baker fired a gunshot that struck the headlight of the acquaintance's car. His friend shot the man in the head and killed him. Even though Baker did not fire the fatal shot under the state's felony murder rule, he was equally culpable for the victim's death. And he told the Indy last week, "It was definitely some very poor decision-making going on." He was sentenced to 28 years, 1 month and 25 days in prison, according to records. Baker says he read incessantly while behind bars and ended up writing a book, A Convict's Perspective, Critiquing Penology and Inmate Rehabilitation. The scholarly volume was published in 2014, 6 years after Baker was convicted in Durham Superior Court. It's available on Amazon, which bought the small firm that first published Baker's work. He was released in August of 2020 after serving about half his sentence. He credits his early release to the nearly 20 criminologists who used his book in their classrooms and the articles he wrote that were published in academic journals. He says it got the attention of people who wanted to see me free. District Attorney DeBerry told the Indy that most people who serve time behind bars return to the communities and never go back into the criminal justice system. The recidivism rate in North Carolina is actually quite low, she says. DeBerry adds the individuals most likely to return to prison are among the community's most vulnerable residents who struggle with health and substance abuse issues. Among the most vulnerable are young men who have been raised in a culture of homelessness and fear with violence as a result. And she says, generally, young people are more apt to return to prison. Quote, as we get older, our brains heal, and we try a different way to live our lives. She adds the biggest challenge formerly incarcerated residents face is finding a place to live. She says, homelessness is a very big deal. A lot of people who went to prison didn't have a home when they went. The issue is even more daunting for individuals who serve long sentences only to be released and find everyone they knew is gone. DeBerry, the problem is exacerbated by difficulties in finding a job that pays a livable wage. She notes that Durham's Ban the Box program allows the city and county to hire formerly incarcerated people on ground crews and the sanitation department. She says Durham is doing a good job. What people need is that first job to show a proven track record to get that second job. Communities can create opportunities, and from there we see people blossom. Once they are able to take care of themselves, they marry, go back to school, have children, or take care of the children they already have. Wednesday's panel discussion will be followed by a Thursday night theater performance by the Motus Theater, a Colorado-based nonprofit whose mission is to create original theater to facilitate dialogue on critical issues of our time. Established in 2019, the Motus Theater's Just Us project amplifies the voices of, quote, community leaders who are impacted by carceral systems to tell artfully crafted autobiographical monologues that expose the devastating impact of the criminal legal system and inspire action toward a vision of true justice. This is all from the nonprofit's website. Justice Project has garnered the praise of Brian Stevenson, the celebrated death row defense attorney and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. He states on the website, I love these monologues because they shift the narrative that has enabled systems of oppression in the United States. The staged reading will feature monologues written by formerly incarcerated people, including five members of the Motus Theater Justice Project, who will arrive in Durham on Thursday. Joaquin Mobley, the project's strategist, is a formerly incarcerated man who is now vice president of the nonprofit Community Works, an employment agency that helps find employment for former offenders, people who live below the poverty line, and, quote, others who are down on their luck. Mobley told Indy that a great many formerly incarcerated people are in the same position he was in after he was released from prison in 2013. You're locked out of opportunities, he says. You really have to know somebody to get into a decent job. Mobley says the most likely people to return to prison have not identified their purpose in life. Moreover, they have internalized society's perception of them as a social pariah. You can see it in their faces, he says. They look defeated. They feel defeated. The project members will share the stage in Durham with DeBerry, along with Jay Augustine, pastor of the St. Joseph AME Church in the historic Haiti district, and Frank Stacio, a retired NPR radio personality who volunteers with the city's Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham. Mobley and DeBerry say they first met when the group performed in Los Angeles in 2021 as part of a Progressive District Attorneys Conference. DeBerry said about that performance, "It was just so powerful. I thought it was something folks needed to see. We rightfully uplift the voices of victims, but a lot of people coming from prison come back to the communities they left, and we don't often hear those voices." When Baker was released from prison nearly 3 years ago, he worked briefly for a law firm but dreamed of starting his own business. He decided to go into trucking, but first got a job driving the vehicles to learn the ropes. He eventually started a trucking company and rented box trucks to make the business go. Now, Baker says he's close to purchasing a trucking management company that would oversee the administrative operations for 25 trucking companies. Before answering what he wanted audience to take away from Wednesday's panel discussion, Baker spoke of how he was in custody at the Johnston County Correctional Institution in Smithfield, where he had handwritten nearly 100 pages of his 192-page convict's perspective. One day, a corrections officer searched his locker, where he found his manuscript and threw it away. Baker says while rewriting it, he would hide the completed chapters in the lockers of his fellow inmates. After completing the manuscript, Baker says he contacted a publisher who wanted to charge him $6 a book for 1,000 copies. Says, "My job in prison," he said, "paid me 40 cents a day to clean toilets. Where was I going to get $6,000? With the help of his mother, Baker self-published the manuscript and did his own marketing by writing to a dozen criminologists and mailing them copies of the book. Baker says he applauds the services offered to formerly incarcerated people, but he says those services should be offered while the men and women behind bars are still serving time. He says there should be more substantive counseling, more educational programs. I would like to make post-prison services obsolete. People should be released from prison as whole adults. So these, as a sideline from this article, is free and open to the public. This panel discussion on life after incarceration will take place April the 26th, and that was yesterday. April 26th. That is today, actually, which is Thursday. And this is a recorded broadcast. But April 27th, which will be today, Satana DeBerry, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Vanderhaden Studio Theater at Duke University. Both events are free and open to the public. I apologize for that mix-up on dates and times. I'm dealing with two different publication dates, and there you go, plus my brain. All right, next we turn to the University of North Carolina system, educational college system. Faculty tenure at UNC system, universities, and community colleges would end under a new bill filed last week. House Bill 715 would, quote, prospectively eliminate academic tenure and establish uniform contracting procedure for faculty at constituent institutions and community colleges. This bill, filed by Representative David Willis, Republican of Union, would make all faculty members at UNC, universities, and community colleges at-will employees, or employees working on contracts ranging from 1 to 4 years. It would compel the UNC Board of Governors to adopt a policy in line with this change in statute. Willis is chair of the North Carolina House Standing Committee on Education and Community Colleges. If enacted into law, the change would apply to faculty hired on or after July 1st of 2024. According to the bill, no faculty member hired by an institution of the University of North Carolina or a community college on or after that date shall receive academic tenure. Under the tenure system, some professors earn indefinite appointments that can only be terminated under specific circumstances and through an established system. It has for years been a target of political conservatives, including some of the political appointees on UNC's Board of Governors. Tenure is intended to protect academic freedom, allowing professors to conduct research, publish papers and books, and engage in speech that might make them political targets. According to the American Association of University Professors, tenure provides the conditions for faculty to pursue research and innovation and draw evidence-based conclusions free from corporate or political pressure. This national academic group's work on the issue going back to 1915 was instrumental in forming the modern conception of tenure in America. Of course, the most recent prominent example of tensions over the concept of tenure in UNC system was the 2021 battle over the Chapel Hill Board of Trustees' refusal to vote on the question of tenure for Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah Jones. Board member and conservative alumni, including mega donor Walter Hussman, objected to the school hiring Hannah Jones because of her views on reparations for Black Americans due to slavery and her creation of the 1619 Project. In letters to school officials and board members, Hussman specifically said tenure may protect Hannah Jones' ability to continue to publish controversial work while teaching at the university. As a political workaround, the university attempted to hire Hannah Jones as a contract employee instead. Public pressure from faculty, staff, students, alumni, and academics around the country finally led to the Board of Trustees voting to offer Hannah Jones tenure. She instead elected to take a tenured position at Howard University, one of the most prestigious of the nation's historically Black colleges and universities, where she raised more than $20 million to create the Center for Journalism and Democracy. Faculty members have pushed back against assault on the tenure in the UNC system for years, saying its elimination would be a blow to academic freedom and shared governance of the universities and could create a chilling effect in terms of research done by professors. Well, that research also comes under scrutiny in the bill. Among a number of other higher education changes, including changes to the power and duties of boards of trustees and establishing minimum class sizes, the bill would require every university and community college to prepare a report of all non-instructional research performed by higher education personnel at the institution. The report, which would be due March 15, would go to the UNC Board of Governors or State Board of Community Colleges and would require descriptions of the research, the subject area of study, an explanation of all funds used in the research, and the costs and benefits of that research. It would also require, quote, recommendations to increase instructional time for students and faculty at each post-secondary educational institution. A number of UNC system schools engage in high levels of research, a draw for both students and faculty. After a similar review mandated by the General Assembly in 2015, the Board of Governors voted to close three academic centers with which its politically appointed members disagree. UNC Chapel Hill's Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity, East Carolina Center for Biodiversity, and at NC Central, the Institute for Civic Engagement and Social Change. The UNC Board of Governors met last week, holding committee meetings throughout the day, and a full board meeting on Thursday, both at UNC Pembroke. Well, turning now for a bit to online, IndyWeek.com, Charlotte Kremen offers this article from the Durham School System. On the afternoon of March the 20th, Allison Swaim, a high school history teacher in Durham, projected a Vox video onto the screen for her students about a campaign to reshape the narrative of the Civil War into one of Southern heroism. The United Daughters of the Confederacy, UDC, established in 1894, successfully pushed the Lost Cause narrative into the classroom at the start of the 20th century. Teachers and textbooks taught children that slavery was not central to the Civil War and that it did not inflict harm on the enslaved. According to the video about the UDC, promoters of the Lost Cause narrative demanded that schools teach, quote, the truths of Confederate history, and urged libraries to mark certain books unjust to the South. 2 days later, Swaim projected another video on the screen, this one from March the 22nd of this year, a live legislative hearing on HB 187, a bill introduced by North Carolina Republicans to restrict how public schools teach about race and identity. Governor Cooper vetoed a similar bill in 2021, but Democrats lost seats in the 2022 election, and the Republican-dominated legislature now has a supermajority, which means it can override Cooper's veto. HB 187 is titled Equality in Education. It passed the House. After a second and third reading, it also passed a first reading in the Senate on March 23rd. Representative John Torbett, the bill's sponsor, said in an earlier hearing, "This great education state must have an education system that unites and teaches our children, not divides and indoctrinates them." Durham educators fear the bill will discourage teachers from discussing social issues, past and present. Many educators do not plan to change how they teach, though, even if their lessons make some students uncomfortable. The bill begins by asserting the equality of all people and continues to lay out an array of ideas that public schools cannot promote. For example, it says instructors would not be able to teach that one sex or race is superior to another, nor could they teach that an individual is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive. They also couldn't tell students that an individual is responsible for the past actions of their race or sex, or that the United States was created to oppress a certain race or sex. These concepts and other parts of the legislation come from an executive order former President Trump issued in 2020 that restricts what federal contractors, the federal workforce, and uniformed agencies can teach their employees. In HB 187, educators offering instruction on race and identity would also have to post content or provide information about speakers on their school's website 30 days in advance. Torbett says the bill, quote, does not change what history standards can or cannot be taught. However, critics of the bill, including Democratic legislators and the Durham Board of Education, have assailed it as a partisan strategy to silence teachers. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the Heritage Foundation, two politically conservative organizations, helped craft the bill. As of March, 44 states have introduced similar bills since January of 2021. On March 9, Durham School Board passed a resolution that opposed HB 187. It said, a sound education, including accurate facts about all aspects of U.S. American history, including systemic racism and discrimination, is guaranteed for every North Carolina student in our state's constitution. Teacher Swaim, who has taught at Riverside High since 2015, says, I'm not going to be changing how I teach. I feel grateful to work in a district like Durham where the whole school board is very much supportive of teaching real things, including looking at racism, sexism, and homophobia. Swaim teaches about a variety of topics, but says that in order to understand history, students must recognize how race and power operate. This has become even more important at a moment when racism is a hot-button issue in America, she said. It's really important for students to understand how we got to this moment, and those are hard conversations. Several of her students were taken aback by the legislation. Nico Bradley Bull, an 11th grader, one of Swaim's students, said in a questionnaire about the bill, "It was surprising to see people advocate for literal, direct censorship of what I consider to be important conversations about race." Bradley Bull said that since teachers are human, they carry natural biases. However, students can think for themselves. Another student, a 10th grader, Rowan Gibney, said legislators, quote, "are trying to control and rewrite history to teach our youth a different story." Michelle Burton, a librarian at Springville Elementary in Durham, taught her second and third graders about Helen Keller at the beginning of March, Women's History Month. One of her students, though, asked if they could instead learn about Harriet Tubman, an abolitionist who helped slaves escape via what was known as the Underground Railroad. Other students chirped in to agree. Burton, the librarian, wonders if HB 187 would permit her to talk about Tubman, whose story involves violence inflicted by white people. She noted that students from various racial backgrounds want to learn about the truths of black history, saying the reason is because how a group of people have overcome and resiliency, which inspires hope. It's inspirational. If the bill passes, Burton is almost sure she will continue to teach as she does now. As a librarian, we focus on intellectual freedom. Opponents of the bill also allude to HB 69, a measure that the legislature passed in 2021 that mandates education on the Holocaust. Minister Paul Scott, a Durham activist who promotes black history education, says they had no reservation thinking their Holocaust bill would hurt the feelings of students of German descent. At the March 14th hearing, Representative Marsha Morey, Democrat, said although it's uncomfortable to learn about atrocities committed throughout the Holocaust, a robust education requires that discomfort, saying much of our history is race-related, and teaching and learning about lynching and slavery and the effects of Jim Crow laws will make students uncomfortable. But a sound basic education is a full discussion of facts of racism in American history. Torbett responded to Morey by repeating the bill will not change history education standards. The Ninth Street Journal emailed Torbett's office three times and his legislative assistant twice for an explanation about what he meant and what would change under the bill, and we received no response. One of the bill's provisions draws particular concern from educators. Educators who plan to teach materials related to the list of restricted concepts must notify the Department of Public Instruction and upload the content onto their school's website 30 days prior to the lesson. The same rule applies when schools hire teachers or consultants who plan to discuss those concepts or have advocated for related ideas in books, published materials, or on social media. Ashley Smith, a Spanish teacher at Northern High School, said, "My concern is they're trying to create a level of fear in teachers who may consider doing this." Smith intertwines different cultural histories into her Spanish classes, including Afro-Latina culture. She would not change how she teaches if the bill were to pass, but she worries about its ripple effect. The 30-day rule could cause teachers to fear retribution for their class material, she said. It could also interfere with educators' teaching methods, Swaim said, adding it would make her job impossible. Even though she always plans general content, students regularly produce questions and feedbacks that change her lessons. I don't have a blueprint that's fixed and set in stone. That's just not how I teach. What's more, teachers say they already vet their materials before sharing them. The school board has to vote on textbook adoptions, and teachers work in teams to develop lesson plans and compile materials. Burton says legislators need to trust teachers instead of policing them. At the hearing on March 14th, Representative David Willis, Republican, denounced concerns over the 30-day rule as baffling. He said most teachers already provide lesson plans in advance. What's important, he said, is accountability. Parts of this nation's history are indeed ugly. However, teachers, quote, do not have the right to insert their own personal beliefs over facts and history. We want all politics, all this nonsense out of the classroom. And the biggest need our children are going to have to be successful in life going forward is the ability to think for themselves. He added, anybody who doesn't understand that should not be in a classroom. Burton, who is also the president of the Durham Association of Educators and worked in education for 28 years, accuses the North Carolina legislature of supporting the privatization of public schools. Many DPS educators, in fact, view HB 187 as part of a broader strategy to dismantle the public education system. Proponents uphold their own framing of the bill. Adults must protect children from a worldview that weaponizes identity to divide and indoctrinate. Torbett said on March 14th, who knows what group will rise to a prominent position to try and indoctrinate our children? We've seen it in history hundreds of times. This bill protects whatever group this is from soiling the minds of our kids with thoughts that don't collectively bring us together as a group of individuals. As Torbett notes, history repeats itself. That's what Swaim's students learned as they drew connections between HB 187 and the United Daughters of the Confederacy. If HB 187 passes, teachers will have to reconcile how to contextualize a world burdened by social issues, which students recognize and seek to unpack with honesty. Smith, the Spanish teacher, puts it this way, not telling the full story of something is also a way to hide the truth. Also from Indie Week, a story published initially at UNC Media Hub. Scientists at UNC Chapel Hill have developed a new method of HIV prevention that could protect users for up to 6 months with just one injection. It is a major step in this field, which has primarily relied on once-a-day oral PrEP medication for the last 10 years. For 6 years, Rahima Benhabour's lab in the UNC-NCSU Joint Department of Biomedical Engineering has worked to create an injectable implant that can release HIV prevention medication over a long period of time. Babenhoor said, there's still about 1.2 million people who get infected with HIV every year. That's just unacceptable on so many different levels, and it doesn't have to happen if there's good preventative methods. In February, Benhabour's team, in collaboration with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, released a paper showing their treatment provided 100% protection from HIV for up to 6 months when tested on non-human primates. The road to human application is long and expensive, though. Babenhoor estimated it could take 2 years to get through an investigational new drug application with Food and Drug Administration and 3 years to get to clinical trials. Regardless of the wait, it is an exciting development for infectious disease experts. Victoria Mobley, HIV-STI, Medical Director with the NC Department of Health and Human Resources, Health and Human Services, says this is really another tool in our HIV prevention toolbox. It's extremely exciting and will help us in our effort to end this epidemic. In North Carolina, Mobley said HIV cases have hit a plateau. Although we're not seeing a significant increase, we're not really seeing a decrease either, which is unfortunate. More than 7,000 people in the state used PrEP in 2021. That's an increase from about 6,000 the year before. This is from a national organization that tracks HIV. While oral PrEP is effective at preventing HIV, the daily pill presents barriers for many patients. For instance, patients may forget to take it. The daily pill works really well for men, but not as much for women, just because the nature of the drugs and how they accumulate in the vaginal versus rectal compartments. So that gives us a lot less forgiveness for women. Men can miss a couple pills and they're still quite protected, but women must, once they miss one or two, their efficacy goes significantly down, they're no longer protected. And financial barriers also play a role in PrEP access. While many patients can find programs to pay for the medication itself, the treatment requires clinic visits and lab tests that many users cannot afford. Mobley said, "Hopefully, with the expansion of Medicaid, we're going to see some of those barriers removed." Patients also face shame and embarrassment related to HIV treatment. There's still the stigma of not wanting to go in and really talk about your risk for HIV and then potentially get a prescription that's going to have the name of a medication on it if you're worried about your roommates, your family members seeing it. Sometimes the stigma also comes at the doctor's office, especially for young people at risk. Armonte Butler, who helps connect young people to sexual health resources. Quote, "Either the providers aren't informed about it well, or they're not informed about why young people need to be taking it." Babenhur hopes that her lab's treatments could help patients avoid stigma by allowing them to get long-acting injections rather than keeping medication on hand. Given the delivery method of the medicine, Babenhur predicts the treatment could eventually be self-administered. The infrequent nature of the treatment could also help provide protection to patients in countries with less access to daily medicine. Quote, "The ultimate goal," she said, "is that it gets everywhere it needs to be, not just in first world countries." When she first got into HIV research, she said she saw a unique opportunity to help women at risk, saying, "As a woman from Africa, I feel a connection to the women in Africa who account for over 75% of all women in the world who are at risk of contracting HIV and who currently live with it. We have much to do to help them, and I believe we can do it." Although Babenhur's treatment isn't on the market yet, the FDA has approved a different form of injectable PrEP. In December of 2021, Apretude went on the market as the first ever form of injectable HIV prevention. It doesn't last as long as Babenhur's lab, with patients required to get an injection every 2 months. As she undertakes the long process of getting her treatment on the market, Benhabur is optimistic about the possibility of curbing this epidemic, saying, "It's a challenging virus, but we've come a long way since the 80s. I think there's still a long way to go, but hopefully not as long as the past four decades." All right, my clock tells me I have about 9 minutes left, and I'll go to stage now. From the North Raleigh Arts and Creative Theater, a production of Equus. That's through Friday of May 7th. And their website, nracc.org. Skin in the Game is this article titled by Byron Woods. One thing is clear. In the Arts and Creative Theater's enracted production of Equus, one scene will be performed in the nude. If it is not, NRACT will be liable for a $20,000 fine from Concord Theatricals, that's the licensing agency for this show, on behalf of the estate of playwright Peter Schaefer. "They're not joking," says artistic director Tim Locklear, who signed a rider stipulating this when he secured the rights to the controversial play at the start of the company's 20th season. Two other writers demanded that the play be performed without any change in text, and that his roles could not be cast cross-gender. The estates of playwrights Samuel Beckett and Edward Albee are both well known for stringently administering production rights to protect the artistic integrity and intent of their authors' works. Both have closed down productions when companies have taken unauthorized liberties with their text. Still, a $20,000 penalty puts new and sharper economic teeth into these practices. I've never heard of such a fine before this, says Locklear. Though it's rarely produced, Equus has long been a well-known work in the theatrical community. Schaefer's psychological drama, which took the Tony Award for Best Play in 1975, remains a regular staple in college theater curriculum. Actor Bridget Patterson said, I read it first as an undergrad in script analysis class, and I loved it so much, I decided to make it my final project for the year. After a mentor encouraged actor Aaron Bowles to read it, the work became the actor's favorite play, quote, for a very long time. I've been waiting around for 5 years plus for it to be produced locally. The iconic drama, loosely based on a true crime, follows a psychiatric treatment of Alan Strang, a teenager who's been institutionalized after he blinded 6 horses that were under his care as a stable boy in the countryside of England. Martin Dysart, a psychiatrist assigned to his case, had misgivings about his profession before meeting Alan. These could only increase as he probes what could cause a boy who loves horses to so violently disfigure them. The plot makes Equus an unconventional mystery, not a whodunit, but a whydunit instead, as it journeys into the maze of a human psyche. In the course, the play becomes an inquiry into the transience of social norms and the ethical treatment of mental illness. And when Alan's dodges and defenses are finally stripped away, Schaefer's work is adamant that the actors in the scene physically follow suit. Director Sean Brosnahan said, this is no B-movie where the woman takes off her top because, hey, we need to sell some tickets. Indeed, a naked and vulnerable boy surrounded by 6 hurt, blind, and deeply frightened horses is not an erotic tableau. It is a disaster, one in which his life is in immediate peril. But how does a theater company go nudity now? In a world where emerging from the pandemic, the artistic community has scrutinized the ethics in a number of the art form's fundamental practices. Brosnahan says 10, 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't, I need this role. We censored ourselves and didn't say, I'm not comfortable in this moment. People aren't scared to do that anymore, which is excellent. It's where we should be. To protect its actors, NRACT will employ current tech in the form of yonder pouches, which Durham Performing Arts and other venues have used to lock up patrons' cell phones prior to performances by comedians and other artists. Patrons' phones will be kept in specially locked pouches during the show. Company personnel unlock and release them afterwards. Locklear says no photos, no video, no streaming, no nothing. But the main way this production protects its actors involves intimacy direction and choreography. In 2015, the Chicago theater community developed a series of safeguards in response to the revelation that a number of productions had, over decades leading up to the 2010s, presented shows where depicted sexual harassment and abuse were not simulations, but real and ongoing, both on stage and off. Many artists and companies in the Triangle communities also adopted these guidelines, known as the Chicago Theater Standards. In the wake of allegations involved in the shuttering of local companies in the past, intimacy direction and choreography are a fundamental part of these standards. And intimacy director Heather Strickland says, when you step into a show that features physical vulnerability on top of emotional vulnerability, it is incredibly important to make sure space has been created in the rehearsal room, to give the utmost care and respect to any artist that needs to step into that moment. In intimacy direction, the actors have agency through the process, and consent is constantly monitored. Intimate scenes are thoroughly choreographed. Each moment and specific movement is mapped out and set so there are no surprises in the performance. The process is inclusive, collaborative, and, according to the participants, liberating. Bowles, for example, says, I've been performing since I was like 10. The production of Equus has created the same space, the safest space I've ever been in as far as a show. Patterson continues, it takes a lot of trust. Having this much care and thought put into caring for the intimacy portions of the show has been the most incredible and most supportive process. Since intimacy figures into most human relationships, even when sex is not a part of the story, Patterson thinks that intimacy direction should be a part of all theater productions, saying, we need this to emotionally care for the actors in this community. When we're met with this level of accountability for ourselves, our bodies, our emotion, and our art, we all grow. Now, from Jordan Lawrence, a music review titled Electric Slide, which I will drastically curtail because I have 1 minute left. Like many short releases, Sunspot's Jo-Fi 1 is hard to judge in the moment. The project, which is a sophomore effort of Durham-based keyboard and synth specialist Joe McPhail, is the first half of a dual EP release with a companion due out in December. It also marks a departure from the eccentrically bedecked but traditionally structured pop-rock songs of Psychical, McPhail's 2021 Sunspot debut. The new effort drops the vocals to focus on the project's distinct instrumentals, which are driven by charismatic keyboard melodies and draped in innovative production that explodes familiar lo-fi textures into thrilling hi-fi. If McPhail continues down the path the EP suggests, it could signal the rise of a truly special voice in indie electronic music. And if Jo-Fi 1 and its companion end just up as quick palate cleanses before the project resumes its initial trajectory, they'd still be fun, fleeting diversions. Jo-Fi doesn't quite rise to the level of electronic luminaries like Dan Deacon or Flying Lotus, but it suggests that McPhail has more than enough talent to reach their level. The only question is where he'll be directing those talents moving forward. Well, here come our motorcycle virtuosos in. Thank goodness they have mufflers on their very large motorcycles. To finish our theme music for Indie Week, John Federson is telling you that he will be back, and I mean it sincerely, next week for the next issue of Indie Week. And until then, the North Carolina Reading Service invites you to listen to portions of this, if you want to, on our podcast section. And so, John Federson saying so long for North Carolina Reading Service and Indie Week.